Shrink Wrap Radio number 429, A Window on Religion and Psychotherapy in Iran, with Dr. Nima Gorbani.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Dr. Nima Gorbani, who is professor of psychology at the University of Tehran and a prolific researcher on personality and Islamic religion, among other topics. He is also a psychotherapist in Tehran, Iran. For more information about Dr. Nima Gorbani, please see our show notes for this episode at shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Nima Gorbani, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, David, for having me on.
Well, it's good to have you on the show. I remember how excited I was to first learn that I have you as a listener there in Tehran. And as I went back in my emails, I discovered that you and I had actually exchanged a couple of emails. And then much later, I heard from one of your students, Mayar. I'm not sure how to pronounce. Is it a her?
Yeah, that's correct. Mayar, yeah. That's correct.
Okay. She had written me that there are a number of your students in the psychology department at the University of Tehran who are fans of Shrink Wrap Radio. So I figured it was time for me to go to the source and interview you directly.
Mm-hmm. My pleasure.
Yes. Okay. Well, I think that we get rather incomplete and distorted views of what's going on there and here. And so I'm particularly excited to have this opportunity to learn about the state of psychology there in Iran. Can you tell us a little bit about the teaching and practice of psychology there in Iran?
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, psychology has been developed since the long war between Iran and Iraq. At that time, in fact, people and the authorities have understood the importance and the necessity of the psychological services for the society.
Mm-hmm.
So the number of students and the number of the university that started a program in psychology. And recently, the number of students rapidly increased, but of course, unfortunately, the quality of the education has not been as high as the number of the students that has been developed. Hopefully, of course, I hope it's going to be better in the future. And we have both undergraduate and postgraduate programs in psychology in almost all of the universities in Iran. And we have the branches of clinical psychology, psychology of exceptional children, counseling psychology, health psychology, and recently there are going to be some interest in industrial and organizational psychology.
Wow, well, that's a very complete program. It sounds like it might be similar to this country where psychology, I believe, is the most popular undergraduate major.
Yeah, that's right. The interest among the society has been rise within the last several years among people who are attracted to the psychology, or the high school students who are attracted to psychology are going to be to choose it as their future programs and future professional, in fact.
Yeah. You know, I'm not sure what the date was of the ending of that war. Do you remember what year that would have been since, you know, psychology started developing there?
Well, in fact, we are close to 20 years ago that the war was ended. And during the war, because of the all kind of problems, for example, veterans and the psychological difficulties among the soldiers, among the people, and also the psychological situation of people who have been the veteran who have been injured during the war. So the society get to know the importance of psychology and try to prepare and train people in order to help those people who are in need.
Yes.
So within these last 20 years, it's going to be get more and more attention in the society, in fact.
Yeah. Well, that's wonderful. And, we too here are dealing with the toll of war and trauma with all the veterans who are returning from various conflicts. And so psychology here also is called upon to try to figure out the best ways to deal with those kinds
of problems. Actually, I see a similarity between the American history and you also after the Second World War. Pay more attention to the psychology as a science and profession. And I think that's the same in my own society.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
mm-hmm.
You've done a prodigious amount of research. You sent me some of your papers, and I was very impressed. And from what I can tell, your research has mostly been personality research and research on the psychology of religion, focusing on the interaction of the Islamic faith there in Iran with a variety of personality inventories and also health conditions. Maybe you can talk to us a bit about the broad sweep of your research and kind of what you found out. Tall order, I know, because you've done so much research.
Well, in fact, my research first started with the idea of self-knowledge. Around 1999, I was interested in the importance of self-knowledge in human functioning and its adaptive role. So I started to study self-knowledge into literature, and at that time, one of the most popular and the famous scales and operationalizations of the self-knowledge in Western psychology was self-consciousness scale. And in fact, this scale, according to the research, revealed the three different factors, social anxiety, public self-consciousness, and private self-consciousness. And clearly, some of these factors was a measure of maladaptiveness instead of adaptiveness. So I was wondering if self-knowledge is a healthy and adaptive construct. In fact, in the Western psychology, we have some sort of measure that clearly are measuring maladaptiveness. And after I studied more, it was revealed in the Western literature that private self-consciousness, which was the most, in some research, it revealed adaptiveness, and in some other research, it revealed maladaptiveness. And there was two factors revealed in private self-consciousness. One was internal state awareness, and the other one was self-reflectiveness. And if you have a closer look at the items in these two factors, with just each of them has, four items, and one of them, which was self-reflectiveness, has items which clearly are measuring a form of obsessive self-knowledge. For example, I always scrutinize my motives, which clearly an obsessional form of self-knowledge. But when you look at the internal state awareness, that was more flexible and more healthy of an internal self-awareness. So I started to develop and scale, of course, with the help and assistance of Professor Watson from the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. We started to develop a theory based on the two dimensions, in fact, in self-knowledge. One was self-knowledge in a healthy way must be integrative, and this integration must be has a temporal dimension, which means when you are, in fact, paying attention to yourself, such attention might be in your moment-to-moment experience, which we call it experiential self-knowledge. And sometimes you are reflecting about your past experience, and according to the past experience, maybe you are planning something which is desired for the future. So we started to consider self-knowledge in two separate factors or two facets, one experiential self-knowledge and the other one reflective self-knowledge. And we develop a large number of items, both in English and Persian, and started to study them in both in Iran and the United States among the university students. And finally, we got the two separate and also similar factors both in both culture, reflective self-knowledge and experiential self-knowledge. But that was the first study we did, and that was, in fact, six serial studies, and in these studies, we evidenced the adaptiveness of this scale and its predictability or its ability to predict mental health was much more powerful than private self-consciousness and other scales. And it also evidenced the reflective self-knowledge had the ability to predict academic performance of American universities, same as the academic performance exams, something like this. I think you have an standard examination in the American university.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, we saw that these two factors were highly correlated, and we did not see any difference in their predictability or in the predictions of the mental health. So we started to develop another scale that, according to this conclusion, that probably the experiential and the reflective factors are very intertwined, so they need to be in one unidimensional scale. So we started to develop another large number of items to develop a scale which was called integrative self-knowledge. And we studied that both again in Iran and the United States, and it turned out of 12 items that could better predict mental health in compared to the previous scales and also in compared to the private self-consciousness that we used to study.
And do you remember any of those 12 items to kind of give us a sense of the kinds of items that were good at predicting mental health?
Oh, yeah. The basic idea is that when you face, for example, a difficult situation, at the same time, both you are experiencing what is happening inside you during the experience, and at the same time, you can keep a distance from your feelings and your thoughts at that situation and keep things in perspective. So it means the items are measuring both closeness and distance perspective of yourself during some frustration or difficulties you have. I do not exactly remember right now, but I can find for you during our interview to read some of the items we have.
Well, that's okay. That's okay. I think you've given us a good characterization. And I have to say that it sounds very similar in some ways to the concept of mindfulness, and I know that's a topic you've been interested in as well. What's the difference between integrative self-knowledge and the concept of mindfulness, if any?
Mm-hmm. Well, in fact, we can say the experiential self-knowledge is very close to mindfulness. But according to the people who theorize about mindfulness in the West, for example, Brown and Ryan, they consider mindfulness as a perceptual and pre-reflective process. But in fact, integrative self-knowledge is not just perceptual or pre-reflective. It's at the same time both considering the experience of experience, the moment-to-moment experience, while you are reflecting on it at the same time, a form of mental capacity which goes beyond mindfulness. But mindfulness is just a bare observation. You just observe what is happening without any analysis or without any reflection or without any interpretation. But in integrative self-knowledge, you have both observation and interpretation.
Okay.
It is like something you have during the course of, for example, psychoanalysis.
Okay. And I got the impression that the idea of self-knowledge also has roots in the Islamic faith. Would I be right about that?
Oh, absolutely right. In fact, of course, it's not just limited to Islam. Many religions and many cultures consider self-knowledge as an ideal. And I was attracted at that time to the concept in the religious literature, in Islamic literature, about the importance of self-knowledge. And if I want to say something about the specific in Islamic traditions, one of the bases of Islamic mysticism is self-knowledge. Mm-hmm. And along with self-knowledge, something which is also considered very important, and it is also revealed a very important finding in my research, is self-control. Or in fact, you need to purify yourself with some sort of disciplines you have taught in the following of a special religion. So, self-knowledge and self-control both are one of the key factors in Islamic mysticism. And if you have seen in some of my papers, there's an idea of perfect man or insan kamel,
yes,
which is component is self-knowledge and self-control.
Yes, and is when you just lost my thought here. When you refer to Islamic mysticism, is that related to or the same as Sufism?
Oh, absolutely right. Yes.
Okay, because there's a lot of interest in the Sufi tradition here in this country for people who are you know, interested in mysticism and they're drawn to the poems of Rumi and Hafiz.
That's right. And one of the key factors you need to consider is that, as you ask me about the difference between mindfulness and integrative self-knowledge, so in integrative self-knowledge, the bare observation or the dispassionate observation or compassionate observation or all kind of definitions in the West are about the mindfulness. It is considered just a bare observation, but I don't think you can observe anything outside of the ideological component of your observation. For example, when you start to observe, start to observe, you surely ask me what I need to observe. So this is the theory or a model or an ideology which guide you to what sort of observation you need to have or what kind of objects you need to observe within yourself. Mm-hmm. So in fact, any system of religions, any system of ideology, for example, psychoanalysis, Islam, Christianity, all they have their own frameworks and techniques,
yes,
and the paths, what you need to be mindful of.
Right. Right. Is there something that could be called a psychology of Islam? And if so, how would you characterize it?
Well, not in fact psychology of Islam, but if you say psychology of Muslims, that's right. And it's a part of the psychology of religion, as you have the psychology of Christians, psychology of Jewish, psychology of Buddhists. So we also have a psychology of Muslims. And in psychology of Muslims, like any other form of psychology of religion, you study the process of internalization of the religion in human being and how religion can affect the cognitions, emotions, and behavior of a given person. So in fact, we have psychology of Muslims. And psychology of Muslims can have two different directions. One, you objectively study Muslims and the effect of their religiousness in their psychological states, and the other one can be considered as a form of religious psychology, and some colleagues call it Islamic psychology, that you extract some assumptions and hypotheses from religion in order to develop the form of psychology based on a given culture.
Yeah, so when you there's some kind of distinction you make between Islam and Muslims, and so I'm not sure what that is. Is Islam sort of the abstract of the religion, and the Muslims is the people who practice
it. Okay, absolutely right. When you talk about Islam or Christianity, in fact, you are talking about sacred texts without considering the people who are in contact with that text.
Mm-hmm.
But when you say Muslims or Christians, in fact, you're considering the interaction of those people with any kind of psychological states with the sacred text.
Okay, yes.
But this is a kind of psychology, in fact.
Right. And earlier you referred to the perfect man, in quotes, which seems to be an important ideal among Muslims in Iran. What can you tell us about it, and what's your research revealed about the perfect man?
Well, in fact, according to the religious Islamic mysticism, one can find the source of the mystery of the world or the truth of the world, not in the phenomenal or material world, but in one's heart, in fact. So it tells us self-knowledge is a must and prerequisite in order to get in touch with the truth. And also self at the same time need to be purified. And all kind of religions, like Islam, have their own disciplines and religious practice in order to help people to purify their self. So the other component would be self-control. So the ideal man or the perfect man is a person who developed a knowledge within himself or herself and also follow a sort of practice and discipline which purified his or her souls. And when you consider them in the ordinary life of people and develop the scales in the psychology, we can call them self-knowledge and self-control. So in our studies, we find out that by the same time, by Mr. Antagni, developed a self-control scale, which we used it in Iran, and it's a very good scale to predict adaptiveness. And at the same time, integrative self-knowledge has also had this power to or ability to predict mental health. But they have limited ability to predict mental health. But when you consider the interaction of both self-control and self-knowledge, their ability to predict mental health would become higher. So in our study, we found out that sometimes self-control without self-knowledge might end up to a form of obsessive self-control, which instead of mental health might be a sign of maladaptiveness.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the self-knowledge without self-control might lead to, for example, you find something within yourself which you cannot tolerate that knowledge about yourself, and it might end up to chaos and discharge of the behavior, like something we see among borderline personality disorder.
Okay.
But at the same time, when we have the combination or interaction of self-control and self-knowledge, then we are reaching to the operationalization of the ideal concept of perfect man. Those people who have both self-control and self-knowledge have a higher state of mental health.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Now, you've also did some research where you looked into the collectivist psychology of the East versus the individualist psychology of the West. And so I'm wondering, you know, what have you found out there, and do you foresee any possibility of future movement toward an integration of the best of these two orientations?
Well, you know, sometimes I think it's difficult to just say, for example, Iranian people have collectivist culture and American are individualist, because in one of our studies that I published in 2003, we compared the individualistic and collectivist values of Iranian students and American. And surprisingly, we find out that the Iranian students' individualistic values was a bit higher than the American students. But of course, we can say that university students are not a good... for example, representative of all part of the society. But I would prefer to say that cultures, whether scientifically or traditionally, have their own psychology, and we can call this form of studies as, if we borrow some concepts from the anthropology, amicus studies. And in amicus studies, you study a psychological phenomena inside of that culture, and you develop, for example, some forms of psychological conceptualizations and scales based on that culture in order to operationalize their psychology. And of course, amicus studies has the negative point of lack of neutrality and empirical validity. But at the other side, we have the ethical studies, which is to stand outside of a tradition and try to study that tradition objectively, like what we have in the scientific psychology in the West.
You know, also, those two terms were new to me. You say they come from anthropology, and I think they might be new to many of our listeners. So entic, is that spelled E-N-T-I-C?
No, E-T-I-C.
E-T-I-C, and then the other one
A-T-I-C. And the other study was EMIC, E-M-I-C. E-M-I-C.
Yes. Okay, so the ethic was the one from the inside, and the...
No. The ethic is stand outside of the tradition.
Okay, and the EMIC is inside the tradition.
Inside of a culture, that's right.
Okay, yeah, it's a useful... set of terms.
An ethical study is all kind of psychological studies, scientific and objective studies that you see in the peer-reviewed journals and scientific journals in the West.
Okay.
And the amicus study, for example, we developed a psychological scale based on religion, which is to specify a specific culture. For example, recently I developed Muslims' experience of religiousness, which is a form of scales coming out of the Islamic traditions and Islamic literature, mm-hmm. and it's specific to this culture. But we can call it amicus studies. And also we have dialogical studies, which try to develop an explicit empirical dialogue between ethic and amic. So in terms of integration, you said, I think Western psychology needs to pay more attention to the amicus studies of diverse culture and try to bring those amicus studies empirically into a dialogue between their own ethic studies. And of course, in this way, we need a kind of innovations in our methodology in order to reveal empirically the presupposition or assumptions we have in our experiments. For example, let me give you an example. In self-actualization scales that you have developed in the West, there's one item in the self-actualization scale which clearly say, I'm not a religious person. And when you give this scale to a religious person, he clearly would be disagree with this item. And then there are some studies in the West which shows religious people are not self-actualized. But Paul Watson used a form of methodology which can be considered within the dialogical approach, that if you translate those items which are anti-religious to the religious items, but at the same time keep the core concepts of self-actualization, and that's what he did with the Christian people. And then you see there would not be negative correlations between religiousness and self-actualization. But at the same time, when you translate those items into religious terms, then you can see a positive correlations between self-actualization and religiousness. So in considering the Eastern psychology or collectivist psychology with the Western psychology, I think we need a form of dialogical methodology in order to have a bridge between the ethic studies and amicus studies.
Okay. Well, we've been focusing on the academic side of your life and your work. Let's move more into your work as a psychotherapist. First of all, I'm wondering how open people are in Iran to the notion of psychotherapy. You said after the war, maybe institutionally there began to be more interest. What about regular people? What's the attitude towards psychotherapy of the person in the street, so to speak?
Well, as the development, as we saw, we see the development of psychology within the last several years, the people's attitude toward the psychological services have been changed as well. So we see much more openness to the psychological services. Of course, we still see, I don't know if you still have it in the United States or not, but if you go to a psychologist, you are a sick person, you are an insane person. We still see some kind of such attitudes in our society, but mostly educated people and young people are very, very open to the psychological safer services, and they come to psychologists to get some psychological help.
Yeah, I would say it's very similar here. As it's as you say, it's kind of a matter of education and class and income and age and what part of the country they come from.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So it'd be very similar there. What about, do you have private practice there? You know, in this country, we have therapists who operate in some kind of an institutional service, such as a community mental health center or within a hospital structure. And then we have psychotherapists who are in private practice. That is, they have an office somewhere or an office in their home.
I have private practice.
Yes. So you have both sorts of going on there. How does private practice function there? For example, here you have to have a license to be in private practice.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. I think if I'm right, maybe 8 years ago, there is a new law. There is a new organization in Iran, which is the Organization of Psychology, and you need to get license from that organization, and they evaluate and review the professionals in order to give them license. So you need to have a license in order to practice psychology here as well.
And what's been the primary influences on your personal approach as a psychotherapist? Which theorists or practitioners have impacted you?
Are you talking about my method in psychotherapy?
Yes.
Well, I'm an intensive short-term dynamic psychotherapist, and I my private practice mostly focuses in this system. And I think you are familiar with this system because you had an interview with John Fredrickson, who is also a practitioner in ISTDP.
Yes, I did. And I had a copy of his book, which I was just very, very impressed with because he had a very practical, down-to-earth approach. And as I recall, he said he wasn't focusing so much on theory as what he gave sample dialogue for all sorts of situations of somebody comes in and they say this, well, here's an example of what you should say back. So it's very practical.
Yeah, that's a very practical book. But you know, the ISTDP was developed by Professor Davan Liu, who's originally an Iranian psychoanalyst. McGill University.
Oh, no, I didn't understand that. I've seen that name, but I didn't know that he was Iranian.
Oh, yeah, he's originally an Iranian, a psychiatrist and also a psychologist, psychoanalyst. And he developed this technique, and this technique is a new form of psychoanalysis which pay much more attention to the moment-to-moment experience of what is happening in the therapeutic relationship. Mm-hmm. More focus on the transference and resistance, and develop some forms of techniques, how to identify, clarify, and resolve the resistance in the patient. So it's a form of short-term psychoanalysis, in fact. And that's a method I use in my own private practice.
Okay, and say the name of it again more slowly.
You mean intensive, short-term, dynamic psychotherapy.
Thank you.
Do intensive, short-term, dynamic psychotherapy.
Okay, thank you. That's good. And you just came from a workshop, actually, with John Fredrickson in Stockholm.
Well, actually, that's not a workshop. John Fredrickson has core training. Core training is a form of supervision you have in ISTDP. And the tradition in training of ISTDP is that people need to have 4 to 5 days of training every 3 months. And they show their videos and would be supervised by their supervisor. And I'm an observer in his core training in order to be more skillful about how to teach ISTDP.
Yeah.
So that's not
great.
A workshop. That's a core training, and I was an observer there, in fact.
Uh-huh. And so you're doing training of that approach in Iran?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And do you incorporate mindfulness into your therapy practice? If so, in what way?
Well, in fact, mindfulness is one of the important ingredients of intensive short-term dynamic psychotherapy. And, of course, recently, if you see one of the, I think, Jonathan Shadler's recently papers, which clearly emphasize that mindfulness is one of the major aim of all form of psychoanalysis. And psychoanalysis, in fact, is a way you help people to be more mindful. But this is much more crystallized in ISTDP, which you need to get the attention or make the patients aware of what is happening just now between the patients and the therapist. You know, in ISTDP, we have a two triangle, which is the basis of the theory of this technique. One is the triangle of conflict, and the other one is triangle of person. In triangle of conflict, we have feeling, which might mobilize some form of anxiety, and anxiety lead patient to use defense. And what is the key differences between ISTDP and other form of psychotherapy is that this triangle of conflict would be clarified in the therapeutic relationship. So it means at the moment, at this moment, you get the patient's attention, what sort of feeling he or she just have. And it mobilizes some form of anxiety, for example, in form of tension in the body or other sign of the anxiety, and it get you to look away, and that's a form of defense. So if you pay close attention, the process of ISTDP, in fact, is the process of developing mindfulness within the sessions. And the patient with just training, with just experiential training, try to be mindful in out of the session and have a clear picture on how the triangle of conflict developed his or her symptoms in different form of relationship he or she has in his life. So mindfulness is one of the core aspects of ISTDP.
Yeah, okay. You know, you mentioned Jonathan Shadler, and I had not seen that paper. It sounds fascinating. He wrote another paper that I thought was really pivotal, kind of defending psychodynamic approaches to psychotherapy in the face of a great tide of cognitive behavioral therapy. And I interviewed him about that, and so the name really resonates for me.
Mm-hmm. I think this is the name of a book he's going to publish, and part of the book is in his website. And one of the key factors I need to clarify, because it has a very important relationship with the integrative self-knowledge I developed, and Shadler also mentioned it in his paper, that we traditionally think that psychoanalysis is exploring patients' past. But in fact, psychoanalysis is not exploring the past, but it is paying attention to what is happening in moment-to-moment experience. And in integrative self-knowledge, you do not explore the past, or when you are integratively aware of yourself, you are not thinking about your past. You are paying attention what you are experiencing right now at this moment. And this experience, when you have a clear attention and awareness to it, might mobilize something from the past, for example, a sort of memory. And that memory mobilizes some sort of feeling right now at this moment. So, in fact, psychoanalysis is paying attention and analysis of what is happening right now. And what is happening right now might be mobilized of something from the past, but it is not exploring the past. In fact.
Yes, right, right. I definitely get that distinction and appreciate it. How does the religious establishment there in Iran impact the practice of psychotherapy, if at all?
Well, I can tell you, we have two forms of reactions. In some very traditional and very conservative religious people, psychology is dismissed totally. But we also have some institute in Iran who educate clergy or mullah who are formally under education of psychology. And that's it. That is something like what you have in the United States, like pastoral counseling, I think, those who are priests and have a formal education in psychology and psychotherapy. And that's what we also have in Iran. There are some clergy who are formally trained as a psychologist, and they try to use psychology within the context of religious terms and religious ideology. So, generally, we have two reactions. One is very positive, but is trying to integrate psychology with religion. And very traditional and very old people just dismiss it.
Well, that sounds
pretty
similar.
But the majority belongs to the first one.
Yeah. Oh, that's good. That sounds pretty similar to the situation here. You know, earlier we were talking about the impact of war and trauma, and I wonder if there in Iran, you or people you know have found techniques or approaches that are particularly effective in dealing with the psychological trauma experienced by veterans.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. There are many similarities between Iran and the United States society.
Actually, I was asking if what the approach has been there in Iran in working with war veterans who are suffering from trauma.
Well, I use ICDP with them. Well, in fact, of course, we have very specific techniques like EMDR in order to work with the trauma. But we also have something similar approach in working with the trauma in ISTDP. So generally, of course, we have some veterans who are badly injured, both psychologically and physically, and mostly they need to take care of with psychiatric medications. But some of them or many of them can get help with the psychological services. And in fact, around 20 years ago, I worked partially in an institute which worked with the injury, the veterans, and we used the psychological services with them, and it was helpful, in fact, with those people. But generally, my approach is no different from the I use with other people, in fact.
Yeah. What's the state of psychologists who are psychotherapists vis-a-vis psychiatry in the history of those two professions in this country, there was tension in the past. I think there's less tension now.
Well, you raise a very important and interesting question, because recently we have some sort of tension between psychologists and psychiatrists in Iran. And, you know, as I told you, the number of students rapidly increased in the last several years. And many psychiatrists are worried about it because sometimes some psychologists go to the healthcare services and doing therapy without have some qualification to do it. So they are worried about it. But at the same time, you know, historically, these two disciplines have a competition with each other.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, in the United States, you have passed those times, but we are still in the time of the tension between psychologists and psychiatrists.
Yeah.
So as I told you, there are many similarities between these two societies.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's amazing.
Another sign of similarity.
Yeah, there are so many similarities. In this country, I would say the majority of students who decide to study psychology, they're interested in becoming psychotherapists. And I wonder if that's the case there as well.
Same as Iran. Mm-hmm. The most attractive branch of psychology in Iran is clinical psychology and doing therapy, in fact.
Okay. Okay. Well, I've kind of run out of the questions that I had prepared, but I'm wondering if there's anything more that you'd like our listeners to know or other topics that you'd like to cover.
Well, I think there is nothing special I can share you. I just am very happy to have this interview, and I know I might be the first person from the Middle East you have interviewed, but I hope I will not be the last one. You know, as long as the colleagues in the West and in the East meet each other much more, and if we publish our research in our own and our other party journals, and if the Western journals, professional journals, especially the APA journals, would be much more open to the Eastern and Middle East psychologists and their findings, I think it would have much more benefit for the Western psychology, because when you understand the psychology of other culture, at the same time you are better understanding yourself and your own psychological states. So I hope we have a more open and more empirical dialogue between the psychologists in the West and in the East, in fact.
Yes, and I totally agree. And having had the opportunity to read your research papers, they're fully up to the standards of the American Psychological Association, and I can't think of any reason why they wouldn't or couldn't or shouldn't be published in our journals. And if you have people who you think I should interview there, just let me know. And I have to thank you for being such a champion of Shrink Wrap Radio there and telling your students about it.
Oh, we are very happy you are doing this job. Well, in fact, I know how difficult it is to run all kind of this interview every week. And I really appreciate that, and I always introduce you and your radio to my students.
Oh, that's wonderful. Professor Nima Gorbani, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Yeah, thank you. My pleasure.
Okay, Eric, here we are again.
Yes, indeed.
So one of the things that blew me away from just a technical point of view is what a great connection we had all the way between Northern California and Iran. Just kind of blew my mind that Skype did not let us down. It didn't fail us. And he was on his home phone. We were on Skype. And so there was a little charge of $3, but $3 is a drop in the bucket compared to what it would have cost years and years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So what stands out for you from this interview?
Oh, so many things. That was just wonderful.
Yeah.
I like his approach, the ISTDP.
Yeah, tell us again what that stands for.
Intensive Short-Term Dynamic Psychotherapy.
Okay, good.
Really great stuff there. And I like his distinction between when you asked him, is it the psychology of Islam? And he said, no, it's the psychology of Muslims.
Yeah, that threw me for a moment.
And it, you know, I think I understood the difference between Islam and Muslim, uh-huh. but I like his definition.
Yeah.
That was really great. And, you know, Islam being the sacred text, and a Muslim is the interaction of a person with those texts.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just a great way to put it. It yeah.
Yeah, and what occurred to me was, well, yeah, I guess we have a similar distinction when we talk about Christianity and Christians, and we recognize that there may be a difference between the two.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's something else that stood out to me were the parallels in terms of cultural reaction
yes.
to the field of psychology.
Yeah.
You know, who's drawn to it, who isn't. It's really similar.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, it seemed like the practice of psychotherapy as he's doing it and the interest among students
uh-huh.
and just kind of structurally, it all sounded so much like this country.
Yes.
And of course, it just heightens the pain of the gulf that exists between us and our governments, our enemies to some extent. And it's just sad that there has to be this gulf between peoples in the world. And I'm sure in every one of those enemy states, there are individuals who are, you know, just good people that we would be able to, if we were to meet, we could dialogue on a heart-to-heart basis.
Yes, and really learn a lot from.
Yeah.
You know?
And I didn't realize that ISDTP, is it ISDTP, originated in Iran.
Right.
That was really news to me.
Uh-huh, yeah.
You know, I was thinking, oh, well, how did you get into this Western approach to psychotherapy? And it turns out it was just the opposite.
Yeah, exactly. It felt almost as if he was calling out the APA.
Yeah.
Saying,
hey, give us some recognition here.
Yeah, I mean, we're doing the same kind of research.
Yeah.
You know, and what we're doing can really advance the field in these other ways, and it really ought to be recognized.
Yeah, it was clear that his approach to psychology is very rigorous.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And you know, he's as well-educated a psychologist as any that I'm aware of. I don't know where. I think he got his education at the University of Tehran, actually. I'm not absolutely certain of that. I could have asked him a little bit more about that. And now, thinking back, you know, like, where did you get your psychological education? I wish I... Such a basic question, and I missed that one. Anything else that stands out to you?
The integrative self-knowledge.
Uh-huh, yes.
And the difference between that and mindfulness, the integrative self-knowledge and the difference between that and mindfulness.
Yeah, yeah, there's some interesting distinctions that were being made there between sort of private self-knowledge. Do I have that right? Private self-knowledge mm-hmm. and public self-knowledge and some other distinctions. And also interesting the way that it sort of ties into Islamic traditions, and also the idea of the perfect man, which, you know, reminds me of the idea of the sort of the ego ideal, if you will, mm-hmm. but within a more spiritual context. And again, in Christianity, people talk about wanting to be Christ-like.
Mm.
And so I think it's that kind of a concept, the perfect man.
Yeah.
Okay, well, maybe we've done it for today.
Sounds great.
Hi, Dr. Dave. Tim here. I'm a psychologist from the Gold Coast, Australia. I was thinking recently it was about time I got off my butt and contributed some money to your wonderful program. It's given me so many hours of pleasure and education, especially on the drives to work. And I think it's important to support your mighty efforts, Dr. Dave. So I'd urge everyone out there to donate, contribute some money to make sure your show, very fine show, Shrink Wrap Radio, is around for a very long time. Okay, see you later.
Hey, Tim, thanks for that very energetic endorsement from down under. Here's hoping it inspires others to join you in that good feeling of knowing they are helping to keep this podcast around for a long time. In that vein, I'd like to thank one donor who stepped up to support the show with a monthly donation since our last podcast. Big thanks go out to listener and donor Sarah Eagleton. Sarah, in my book, you soar like an eagle. Hey, listen up, all you professionals who need to periodically update your licensing with continuing education units. I'm happy to announce our new holistic and nutritional approaches to treating psychological disorders for 5 CEUs. It's available through the fully accredited Zur Institute, and you can find a link to it on our website under the Store tab. It's reasonably priced at less than $10 a unit. And by the way, you don't have to be a professional to purchase the course. Anyone can do so and use it to beef up your resume or just for your own personal satisfaction. I've started posting video clips on YouTube announcing the current shows. You can check these out on my new YouTube channel, which you'll find at www.youtube.com/user/shrinkwrapradio1. As you know from recent shows, I'm currently doing some advertising here for audible.com, which, as I say, I feel very good about inasmuch as I've long been one of their customers. By the way, they do very good customer satisfaction work. I recently downloaded a book that was not what I thought it was going to be, and I called them up and asked for a refund of the credit. And not only did they do it in very friendly fashion, but it's the second time I've done that, and both times justified. But for the most part, they're very good at delivering exactly what you're looking for, because like you, I love getting good audio content. So I have a new audiobook recommendation for you. How about Man's Search for Meaning by the noted existential psychoanalyst and concentration camp survivor, Viktor Frankl? Maybe it's a book you always meant to get around to. Now you can listen to it the easy way to read it. You'll get nearly 5 hours of educational information from this unabridged audiobook. Or you can choose any one of more than 165,000 titles for this introductory offer. So if you're not already an Audible.com subscriber, you can get this audiobook for free with no obligation to continue your subscription by going to audibletrial.com/shrink. Finally, you know there's an Amazon widget in the right-hand sidebar on our site. Do you know you can use that to order not just books, but anything at Amazon? I know many of you probably use Amazon regularly to purchase all sorts of things. Plus, the season of giving is upon us, and many of you will probably purchase at least some of those gifts on Amazon. If you'll use the search tool in our widget, it will automatically add our affiliate code, and Shrink Wrap Radio will get a small percentage of the purchase. It's another way that you can help to support us.
Hi, this is Lloyd from Australia, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Lloyd from Australia. Hey, I know you've heard me say this before, folks, but I could use some creative new short snippets like this one. You can even use our message phone to record them, so there's no excuse not to. Now let's turn to a recent email from our listener community, and this one is from that new donor, Sarah, who I mentioned earlier. And Sarah writes, "Dear Dr. Dave, I finally made it to your website after listening to your podcasts on and off for 2 years. They kept me company through all sorts of transitions, through moving from one country to the next, marriage, pregnancy, and motherhood. Your gentle voice and fascinating interviews widened my horizons as I packed boxes, went for long walks while cradling my ever-growing belly, and breastfed. I am now the happy mother of a beautiful 6-month-old boy, and for what feels like the first time in years, I have a little breathing space thanks to a very lovely au pair who recently joined our family and is enabling me to spend an hour at a time away from my baby to write a dissertation." Wow, a lot on your plate. She goes on to say, "I'm a trainee, integrative arts, psychotherapy, and a child counselor. I have 1 year of training to complete in the UK and am currently taking my second year out of studying in order to move with my husband and have a family. I will return to the UK in January, and in the meantime, I'm writing a dissertation for the counseling course. I wanted you to know that your podcasts have helped me feel connected to the world I left behind. In moments of hormonal pregnancy fog, far away from home and family, they kept me company and helped me to maintain interest in the world, keeping my passion for psychotherapy alive. Furthermore, you have such a warm voice and kindness with your words that it is a comfort to know that you are out there in the world and making all this wonderful information and topics of interest available to all who are interested. Thank you. Since I've listened through my iPhone all this time, I never found the opportunity to log on and donate, though I often intended to. It's worth noting that I have been a student for years and always felt quite poor. However, I also recognize that we constantly prioritize and make choices about what we spend our money on, and that I could shuffle some of my expenses, making room for a donation. In my case, donating to your show means having one less tea time treat out each month. I say this because I wonder if other listeners are feeling poor without realizing their own power of choice. Today, I finally logged on and began to download transcripts of podcasts I've listened to. I thought of transcribing for you, but realized that my time is still limited. In the meantime, I set up a monthly donation as the very least I can do, and I look forward to enjoying many more of your interviews. Wishing you all the best, Sarah. Well, Sarah, thank you so much for that high praise and also for your decision to start making a monthly donation. And I realize that your situation is probably not unique in terms of being someone who listens on the iPhone, and therefore it's just not quite as convenient maybe to make the donation on that little small screen. And so I imagine that many out there, like you, harbor a long intention to become a donor, but then forget or something like that. So any of you who are listening, please follow in Sarah's footsteps and tie a string around your finger or something and go ahead and make that donation. And I thank you in advance. Okay, so once again, we'll wrap it up with that. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemail on our message phone at 415-830-4014. And you can leave voicemails using our iPhone/Android app, which I'm happy to say many of you are doing. And you can get full details about that in the Apps tab on our site. Thanks again to today's guest, Dr. Nima Gorbani, for giving us some insight into the practice of psychology and psychotherapy in Iran. My next interview will be with return guest, Dr. Barry Krakow, whom I interviewed about 2 years ago on the topic of sleep and insomnia. He works at the Maimonides Sleep Center in New York City and has recently completed research on insomnia that has produced important new insights. So be sure to join us. Until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.